Hello there. Today is Wednesday, March 22nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president's Supreme Court nominee faces another day of grilling.
A good judge doesn't give a whit about politics or the political implications of his or her decision.
Will Republicans get the votes this week to repeal Obamacare?
I think at the end we're going to have a fantastic bill.
A group that's bringing refugees together with food. Also ahead, we'll get reviews on the latest newly released movies here in the U.S. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch stressed his independence from the man who tapped him for the post, President Trump, in a second day of confirmation hearings Tuesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Gorsuch also said he isn't beholden to any political party. He told the panel that no Trump administration official has ever pressured him to promise how he would vote on any of the hot-button issues like abortion that could come up before the high court in the coming years.
I have no difficulty ruling against or for any party other than based on what the law and the facts in the particular case require. And I'm heartened by the support I have received from people who recognize that there's no such thing as a Republican judge or a Democratic judge. We just have judges in this country.
VOA correspondent Michael Bowman, who was on Capitol Hill for the first 2 days of hearings, gives International Edition's Ira Melman some highlights on what he saw.
We saw Senate Democrats really trying to drill down into what Neil Gorsuch believes, what he doesn't believe, as far as cases that have already been decided, such as Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion in the United States, and also perhaps pending matters that could come before the court, such as an amendment or an attempt to change Roe versus Wade, or questions of corporate interests, or questions of religious freedom. These were areas where President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, a federal appellate judge, very much refused to say how he might rule in any pending case, in any litigation that may come up before the court, as is the tradition of all nominees for the Supreme Court, and in fact all judicial nominees. None of them want to tip their hand as to how they may rule, and they all maintain that they will be an objective and independent thinker when they are placed on the court. And Neil Gorsuch very much held true to that conviction, I suspect to the consternation of Democrats who are really trying to get a sense of just how conservative a justice President Trump has nominated.
There is a political background to this, and for those unaware, can you kind of fill people in?
Absolutely. If confirmed to the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch would replace Antonin Scalia, who was an arch-conservative on the high court, one of the strongest conservative voices. He died in February of last year during President Barack Obama's final year in office, and President Obama nominated a different appellate court judge by the name of Merrick Garland, who was widely regarded as a moderate, as a judicial moderate, but Senate Republicans argued that no high court seat should be filled during the heat of an election year, during the heat of a presidential campaign, and that therefore, since they held the majority in the Senate and they could decide whether hearings would be held or not on Merrick Garland, they declined to hold hearings at all and essentially kept the seat vacant right up until the present day. And Democrats, to a person in the Senate, say that while indeed Neil Gorsuch is entitled to the very same consideration currently that Republicans denied to Merrick Garland, that the past is not forgotten. There are many Democrats who believe that, in essence, Republicans stole a Supreme Court seat from Democrats that a Democratic president would have been able to fill but for the refusal of Senate Republicans to allow a hearing to go forward. There are very raw emotions on this question right up to the present day.
That's VOA correspondent Michael Bowman talking to Ira Millman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The UN says conditions in Afghanistan are deteriorating and kids are at great risk. A rare poll finds Cuban citizens favor better U.S. relations. An African trade conference with no Africans. Sanctuary churches in the U.S. are mobilizing to help the undocumented. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump says he thinks Republicans have enough votes in the House of Representatives to win a key vote on Thursday to repeal the national health care law that President Barack Obama considered his signature legislative achievement. The president wooed lawmakers who've been reluctant to support his plan, even either because they believe it doesn't go far enough in overturning the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, or conversely because it would leave too many poor people without health insurance. He also held a political rally late Monday in Louisville, Kentucky, to make his case.
We have a bill that's going to be negotiated. You know, it doesn't happen. You put it in and they go back, and I think at the end we're going to have a fantastic bill. And the alternative is Obamacare, and Obamacare is killing Kentucky. It's, you know, I was in Tennessee. They've already lost half of it, so half of it is now dead. The insurance companies left. You're going to lose your insurance companies if you haven't already lost them. And it's been a disaster for Kentucky, as you know.
House Speaker Paul Ryan also leaned on lawmakers.
The president of the United States came to us and said, we all made a promise to the American people, and we need to keep our promises. Everybody running for Congress in the House, everybody running for Senate, the president himself said to the American people, you give us this chance, this responsibility, this opportunity with a Republican president, with a Republican Senate and a Republican House, and we will repeal and replace Obamacare. We made a promise. Now is our time to keep that promise. And we keep our promise and the people will reward us. If we don't keep our promise, it will be very hard to manage this.
Well, no Democrat in the House has announced support for repealing Obamacare. Many Republicans also not sure they'll vote in favor. The Independent Congressional Budget Office last week cast doubt on whether the Republican replacement plan will prove to work better than Obamacare, concluding that 24 million Americans will lose their coverage over the next decade if Trump's plan is adopted. Well, we have been witnessing the highest levels of displacement the world has ever seen. An unprecedented 65.3 million people globally have been forced from home, among them nearly 21.3 million refugees, more than half of whom are children. Now, many are fleeing war or persecution in their homeland and will never return. But dinners have been hosted around the world as a way to welcome these new families. A human rights lawyer is expanding on the program here in the U.S., and it's called Refugees Welcome. It calls for a celebration of love of community and friendship. Human rights attorney Gisu Nia joins me now to talk more about it. Thanks so much for being with us. So what's the basic idea behind your program?
Refugees Welcome is an effort to bring refugee and non-refugee folk around a dinner table to have them break bread and share stories and learn more about one another and build relationships. So we're working with UNICEF and other groups in the development sector around these efforts, and we had noticed that there's been really great energy in the U.S. as connected to faith communities and also expat communities around holding these kinds of dinners. And usually the efforts are led by like a church, a synagogue, or a mosque, or in the Syrian expat community, they have a lot of dinners. I'm Iranian American. In our community, there's a lot of dinners for folks that have just newly arrived to the U.S. But I did notice that outside of those communities, a lot of people were not aware that these dinners were happening and that when they heard about it, they were super keen to host one, to attend one, to just learn more about it.
And I understand you have quite a few of them coming up.
We have a bunch locked in towns and cities across the U.S. We had two really great ones in New York We had one in Boise, Idaho. We had one in San Diego. So it's a range of cities and towns, just really looking to get a great mix of people around a table to do what comes naturally to most of us, which is have a meal and make some conversation.
Where are some of these refugees that are attending the dinners from?
A lot of them are from Syria. A lot of them have escaped the conflict there. There's many others as well from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Iran, Afghanistan, Iraq, Sierra Leone, Rwanda. The list goes on and on. Some of the folks are people who were journalists or activists in their home countries who then had to flee because they lived under dictatorship and it was no longer safe for them to be there. Some of them are families, so they're not like individuals who came over, but they're families. They come with small children and they're escaping conflict in Syria and Iraq. So it's really a mix of folks. As part of Refugees Welcome, we've sort of stayed flexible on what meal model, you know, folks should have at the dinners or at the lunches or whatever it is that they put together. But we put together a really light toolkit around, you know, just suggestions of how to spark conversation, how to stay in touch, and how to make sure that this isn't just a one-off, you know, that this is just the first of many other gatherings they might want to have moving forward.
What's your sense at these dinners, the ones that you've attended? Put a human picture with
this. Yeah, it really depends, I think, on a few factors, but one is definitely language, right? So at some of the dinners where all the folks that are attending speak English, those tend to feel like supernatural in that, you know, it's just as if you're attending any dinner and the folks around the table just have really interesting stories about recently coming and, you know, what they experienced, and everybody has something to share. At the dinners where people are still learning English, we have interpreters, and usually that comes through like different pro bono volunteers that work with local communities and just come to the dinner as well. I think everybody can bond through the language of like food and shared culture and shared experiences. And one of the main things is everybody talks about their children. So one thing that is universal is that experience of being a parent. And I've found that that's a really easy commonality between a lot of people that attend. A lot of people walk away from the experience having exchanged information with different folks at the dinner. So that was encouraging to me, just like in my anecdotal observations, that people were exchanging information, taking photos with one another, and it seems like they'll stay in touch.
It's called Refugees Welcome. We know there's been a lot of controversy about refugees in this country recently. What's the message you're trying to send?
Refugees Welcome with a heart. So there's a little heart emoji after it. Use it in the hashtag as well. And I think that actually speaks to the message we're trying to send, which is that this is very heart-centered. And I know that already at some of the dinners that we've had, there's folks that are across the political spectrum in this country who may have voted for a particular candidate, but then also because of their faith are very welcoming to refugees. And I think that can be a really interesting duality. We definitely want this to feel very inclusive and very much like getting people to connect on a human level. There's definitely motivation in putting these dinners on for people basically to see that they actually have so much in common, even if they're from other sides of the world.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Human rights attorney Gisu Nia, the program is called Refugees Welcome. Thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a trip to the movies. We're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hi, Jeff. So we've got Beauty and the Beast. How was that?
Well, you know, when Disney came with their big comeback back in the 90s and they revitalized their classic animation division, you know, with The Little Mermaid and then with Lion King, but Beauty and the Beast was their real crown jewel. Even though Lion King is tremendously popular too, this was Beauty and the Beast was the first animated film to be nominated for Best Picture by the Academy. It had incredible songs. It was also a Broadway live version for many, many years. They finally have gotten around to doing Beauty and the Beast, and they have pulled out every stop to make the most incredible, lavish musical you could ever imagine. $300 million for Beauty and the Beast. And it's got an all-star cast, including Emma Watson, who is Hermione from all the Harry Potter films. Essentially, it's a shot-for-shot remake of the animated film. It has all the songs everybody loves. It's got great special effects. It's also got Josh Gad and Luke Evans as LeFou and Gaston. It's just an amazing accomplishment in terms of the special effects, the music, and just doing that Disney magic. And it's been a hit already, a tremendous hit from its opening weekend. Also, the big controversy about Disney making Gaston and LeFou. LeFou is the first gay character in a Disney film. He kind of fawns all over Gaston, who's this big hunk of a man. He's like the little comic relief. And I have no problem with that, Disney making it a gay character, but I just don't like how he's the comic relief. They kind of ridicule him and make him the punchline. Mm. And I just thought that was inappropriate.
Okay. Good for all ages?
I think parents are going to take their kids to show, kind of share that excitement they had for the original animated film, which, you know, can kind of look kind of dated, you know, from the early 90s. But I think families are absolutely going to adore Beauty and the Beast, and it's already shown in the box office return, so they got a huge hit on their hands.
And we've got the Belko experiment. What is that?
Well, it's a really insulting kind of tasteless horror film.
Oh, okay.
There was a movie back, you know, 25 years ago called Battle Royale, which was a movie from Japan that was banned in the United States because it was about all these school children from Japan who were kind of like bad in society. So they put them on an island and they say, look, you 50 kids, whoever survives this weekend, whoever's the last one alive gets to go home. So they're saying essentially kill each other. So it was really a brutal kind of social experiment. And that's what the Belko experiment is. It's a social experiment where in Bogota, Colombia, all these Americans work at the Belko company, and all of a sudden they're trapped inside this five-story building. All these doors come down, and a strange voice comes over the intercom and says, look, we want 30 of you dead in the next 2 hours, and then after, if you don't, we'll kill 60 of you. And if that doesn't happen, you know, whoever lives gets to survive. So you see how all these groups break down and all these brutal murders going on. So it's just a really tasteless kind of movie with lots of violence, and people enjoy that kind of thing. But I just thought it was a really tasteless movie.
All right. Well, we always appreciate your honesty. Thanks so much, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. And turning now to what's been trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palcheski. Hey, Andrew, what's the talk today?
Well, every year, twice a year, Twitter releases what they call a transparency report, and they've been doing this for the past few years, where they give information about requests they've received from governments and other entities. This year, for the first time, they've published information about how many Twitter accounts they've shut down that have been affiliated with terrorism or pro-terrorism groups. And since from the second half of 2016, they've shut down about 377,000 Twitter accounts, of which they said the vast majority, nearly three quarters, were found internally through their spam fighting tools. So it wasn't as though these were reported by governments. They were actually discovered by Twitter.
Wow.
And shut down. And so they're releasing this for the first time to give a sense of the fight that they're waging against the propaganda mm-hmm, and the mm-hmm. pro-terrorism content that's being spread on social media. This has been something that ISIS has done a lot of. They've used social networks
right.
to try to spread their propaganda to recruit. For the first time, we're seeing the other end of that. We're seeing the back end and so how the social media companies are working to shut that down. And for Twitter to say that they've shut down 376,890 accounts associated with terrorism, that's a big chunk.
That is. That's very impressive for sure.
Absolutely.
So I understand people are also talking about a very holy subject, or at least someone in a holy place.
Yeah, when I look for advice or input on social media, I look at a lot of different places. I can't say that I've ever looked to Pope Francis, but Pope Francis, he has released a statement about social media, warning young people against getting sucked into it and the false reality that presents. We've seen studies time and time again that say social media can actually make you less happy because you see everybody on vacation, you see everybody having a good time.
I agree.
You think, why am I not on vacation?
Exactly.
I'm stuck here at work. Mm-hmm. Well, he says, quote, in the social media, we see faces of young people appearing in any number of pictures recounting more or less real events, but we don't know how much of this is really history. And he goes on to say, don't let yourselves be led astray by this false image of reality. He also warns against reality television, saying that doesn't present exactly the best image of things. But we see a lot of this. It can actually cause some real-world ramifications when people edit photos, Photoshop themselves on Instagram or other places, and people try to go for an unrealistic image of what they try to be. So some wise words from a very high place, warning against getting too sucked into the supposed truths that we see on social media.
But doesn't he have a Twitter page?
He does. I haven't seen any photoshopped pictures of him or anything, so I think he's living up to his word. But no, actually, it's very interesting. You know, they talk about Pope Benedict being the Twitter Pope, the first Pope to have a Twitter account.
Right.
Pope Francis has gone all out. He has Twitter. He has Instagram. He puts things up in all different languages to reach all the different Catholics around the world.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew Palcheski. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a new production of Arthur Miller's play The Price opened on Broadway this month. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the play starring Mark Ruffalo, Tony Shalhoub, and Danny DeVito looks at the costs people pay for the choices they make.
The play is set in the attic of a crumbling brownstone where Victor Franz, a New York cop who abandoned his dream of becoming a scientist, has come to sort through his parents' stuff before the building is demolished. Danny DeVito plays the used furniture dealer that Victor has hired to appraise the contents of the attic. Arthur Miller wrote The Price in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War. Though the play is set in the 1960s, Mark Ruffalo says it feels appropriate in the current political climate.
68 wasn't very different than 2017 politically, culturally. There was all these huge cultural shifts. There was a distrust in our government, distrust in our media, distrust in our political scene. There was a question about a real serious question going on about capitalism and how good it is for a society to be so slavish to capitalism. And then there's always just the universal family drama that Miller uses as a framing to dive into a lot of these big questions and themes.
Jessica Hecht plays Victor's wife, Esther. She says that this production hit at just the right time.
You know, the timing could not have been better because we were slated to do it a couple other times, and then it just sort of dropped into this time. Although Obama came a few weeks ago, and he said, well, if we had done it during my presidency, it would have been the same. He was so magnificent as a person, just because, just as you're talking to me and want an answer about what I feel, that's the way he is. He talks to you with such grace and such interest, and he seemed to really love the play, and his daughter was exquisite, yeah.
DeVito's character Gregory Solomon is just about to seal the deal with Victor when Victor's brother, successful Dr. Walter, played by Tony Shalhoub, shows up. Walter left to go to medical school while Victor stayed to take care of their father. And DeVito says The Price, like many of Miller's works, plays on timeless themes. What does a father owe a son, or a son owe a father? And what do brothers owe to one another or to their parents?
So it's like it's very current because it's talking about people. It's talking about the human condition. I mean, what you do to make ends meet. And it's not like, you know, all about the elite and about like taking money and sticking it in with bombs and guns and, you know, spending our hard-earned money with our energy. We should put it in the arts because that's where we need it.
The play opened just after President Trump announced his budget outline that would eliminate, among other things, funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. Mark Ruffalo said that that would be a mistake.
Yeah, we have to fight like hell right now. And the one good thing about this moment is I see people coming from all walks of life joining together in this great endeavor of maintaining our humanity in the face of this monstrosity.
The Price is directed by Terry Kinney and is scheduled to run at the American Airlines Theater until May 7th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's the start of spring, and the ancient festival of Nowruz is currently being celebrated by peoples from various countries and backgrounds around the globe. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson sent greetings on this holiday, which means new day, and also marks the beginning of a new year. Millions of people across the world, including communities in Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, China, Georgia, India, Iran, Iraq, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Russia, Syria, Tajikistan, Turkey, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and many other peoples of South and Central Asia and the Persian Gulf celebrate this time of the year with their families and friends, Mr. Tillerson said in a written statement. Today, many Americans will join in this celebration, sharing with a new generation the cherished traditions of their ancestors. Secretary of State Tillerson said, "Nowruz is a time to look toward the coming year with hope and optimism. We look forward to celebrating this new spring together and hope that this Nowruz brings peace and prosperity to all."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
is for, what's the universe?